For 35 years, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation has been dedicated to saving thoroughbred racehorses no longer able to compete on the racetrack from possible neglect, abuse, and slaughter. The oldest and largest charity in the U.S. devoted to racehorses, the TRF makes a promise of lifelong sanctuary to those horses unable to pursue a second athletic career. Unique within the aftercare industry, the horses of the TRF find their second chance in the role of teachers through the TRF Second Chances program, which provides vocational training in 7 correctional facilities across the U.S. The program is Saving Horses and Saving Lives. Learn more at www.trfinc.org, and please use the special In the Money podcast link to donate, trfinc.org/players. You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is show number 88. It is Monday, November 11th, Veterans Day. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you once again in the Brooklyn Bunker. Breaking format a little bit today. JK is making his way back from California. He made a valiant effort in the Del Mar Betting Challenge, was not able to get his name on top of the leaderboard in the end, but did walk away with some money. We'll talk to him about that when we get him back on the air. So in his stead, the co-host for most of today's show is our correspondent, our international correspondent, Naomi Tucker. Naomi, how are you today?
Hi, Pete. I'm good. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Things are excellent. You know, it's a funny day because Perrin, the school she goes to, has school today, but there's the public schools are off. So the city is kind of, it's like a Sunday feel. I got her to school in, I would say, about a third the time that it usually takes. It's kind of nice to have a little bit of extra goings on, a little bit of extra time to get things done, and almost like a working holiday for me here in Brooklyn today. I wanted to ask you about your location. I usually introduce JK as being from the planet Texas. You're coming to us from the planet Holland. Is that right?
That's correct. I'm currently visiting my family in the Netherlands.
And whereabouts are you? And are you working while you're over there, or you're just hanging out and having some holidays and I'm making you work?
Well, I wouldn't say that this is much work, but I am just visiting my family, which has been great. It had been a fair few months since I've been there, but I'm actually in Zeist, which sounds very strange, but it's near Utrecht, which is the place where I was born and raised. So it's always great to be home, and it's intriguing because in a way you're away from racing, because we have racing here, but not as much. So for me, it feels like I'm away from racing, whereas when I was living in England, you just know it's all around you. But here, yeah, slightly different.
I would say so. You've been on our airwaves a bunch. You have an interview a little bit later on in this show with Brad Cox that we're very much looking forward to. But one thing I've been remiss a little bit in doing is introducing you to the listeners in terms of your background. They now know where you're from. They know you've spent time in England. But how did you get the racing bug in the first place? When did horses first become important to you?
So my first encounter with horses was when I was about 9 years old. I used to go on holidays, and then I found sort of a hobby that I thought was really interesting, and that was riding little ponies and horses on the beach. So I started riding in the early days, and then I got very fortunate to have my own, well, pony, as we call them here, but she was actually quite big. She was over 15 hands. She was an Anglo-Arabian, so she was basically half Arabian, half thoroughbred, so I'd say maybe the worst cross that you can have. She was quite feisty. She had her, you know, she really, really wanted to get things her own way. And it just taught me so much about horsing. I used to compete with her in dressage and show jumping until I figured out that actually she was much better suited doing other things. And that was endurance. So I ended up doing endurance competitions with her. But then there was a lady here in the Netherlands who organized pony racing. And I was about 15 at the time. Thought, okay, well, this sounds interesting. Let's have a go at this. So I, put her on a trailer and we went to Duindicht, which is the only proper racetrack we still have in the Netherlands. And after that first time, I think we finished third in the Dutch Pony Derby.
Not bad.
And honestly, I was hooked. That was, for me, that was it. I went, this is amazing. We can go fast. I can have fun. And also my horse loved it as well. So the lady that organized that, she also organized a trip to Newmarket, So I was 16 at the time. We flew over to London, and then there was a whole group of us that visited Newmarket. So the first time I saw thoroughbreds canter up Warren Hill, it was really cold and crispy. They had those Whitney sheets on, and they were, you know, going through their paces. And I remember standing there looking at this world that I basically didn't know much about as of yet, and went, this is it. I'm going to be a part of this. This is what I'm going to do. And I had no clue in what capacity yet, but I was like, this is what we're going to do. So I ended up applying for the British Horse Racing School, which is in Newmarket. Got in the same week. So on a whim, applied to that, got in, but then didn't attend until I was 18 because I finished my education in the Netherlands first. And then I started with that, basically started working horse racing, like learned how to ride thoroughbreds, which is completely different than riding Dutch warm bloods or even my, you know, Anglo-Arabian mare. So basically went from there and haven't looked back ever since.
It's a really an amazing story. And I could see, and for the listeners out there, if you're thinking of doing any racing travel, we've talked a lot about Ascot. That should be on everybody's bucket list. But a morning at Newmarket, when you're there and you look up at the hill and you see a set walking across perfectly silhouetted by the sun, I could see how that could be a life-changing experience, as it was for you. And then I know you kept riding. Did you ride when you were in England as well on any sort of amateur basis, or was your amateur riding all limited to what happened in the Netherlands?
Oh, no, I had an amateur license, but I had very few rides. So that really, I don't feel like that counts for anything. It was more that I ended up exercise riding in different tracks or at different tracks across the world that really, you know, that was really something that I enjoyed so much and has taken me to all these different places. So I ended up riding for a year at Royal Randwick in Sydney for two Group 1 winning trainers in Graham Begg and Anthony Cummings. And then for the trainer I rode for in England, well, I actually rode for a pre-trainer, so that was breaking and two-year-old sales consignment. And we broke in about 300 a season. And he used to, well, he still does, has the contract to prep the Hong Kong Jockey Club horses. So every year we used to take a set of about 12 horses over there and they then get sold. I did that 2 years and was there for a month in Hong Kong, which is really, you know, you get the chance to look at all these different racing jurisdictions from a whole new point of view, because instead of you being on the sidelines, you're actually on the track. You're speaking to the other riders, you're speaking to the trainers. And I really felt that that has given me, you know, so much joy, but also so much education in terms of the differences or, you know, the things that work for horses in those jurisdictions, or even just the differences in physicals when you're sitting on these horses that are just, you know, bred a little bit different and trained a little bit differently.
When you think about the places you've been around the world, whether it's Hong Kong or England or Australia, what do you feel like is a lesson from around the world that we here in USA Racing should maybe do a little bit better job of taking to heart?
I think it's different comparing different racing jurisdictions in the way that, you know, horses are trained out there. Because if you're looking at the US, for example, the way that we travel around our horses, that can be quite intense, but also doesn't allow for a lot of horses to have much of a break. Whereas, for example, what I very much enjoyed in Australia, the way that they're, you know, dealing with their young stock as well as their older horses, and I think massively contributed to the fact that, for example, Wings ran on for many, many seasons being able to do so, is because they give their horses a break. And not just a break, it's in, oh, we'll go and trot them a little bit and they're still in the stable. They turn their horses out. They send them to spelling farms, as they call it, and they'll just be roaming around on grass for about 3 or 4 months, really allowing, for example, young horses or the older horses in training to really freshen up, put some weight on, or even recover from tiny little injuries that we might not know that much about, because you're not scanning your horse's bone every single day. But even those little things, they allow them to, you know, be a horse and really heal. And I'd love to see that more in other jurisdictions, but I know that in Australia it's a very cultural thing, and I admire that.
That you use the exact phrase I was going to use, the idea of letting a horse be a horse. I also want to ask you the flip side of that question. Obviously, you're attracted to USA Racing, or you wouldn't be in the process of moving your own tack here. What's something about US Racing that excites you as opposed to racing around the world?
Well, initially, it's for someone coming off the back of, you know, riding racehorses and riding on turf and following turf races across the globe. It's sometimes dirt racing, it's not as attractive at the beginning, or it wasn't for me at the beginning. You're watching it, but you don't, you know, you don't really get the excitement because you're not there. And then when I was in Kentucky for 6 months during the Godolphin Flying Start program, which is a wonderful program that I've really, you know, I'm so fortunate that I was able to do it, you actually get so much more hands-on involvement. Now, I got the chance to ride out at Keeneland for Johnny Burke, who's the sort of the rehab or the rehoming trainer for Godolphin. So he really gets all the horses that really just need to get back into training again. But it's when you're really close to actually, you know, every day being on dirt and following the dirt racing. But I think that what really captured me was the road to the Kentucky Derby. That whole frenzy, what they're now going to start doing, you know, looking at those horses and really start thinking, which is that next horse that might complete that illustrious Triple Crown? And for me, I was in the US in 2018 when Justifying won the Triple Crown. That was just something, that whole, you know, those races and that timeline, that was something that I've never experienced before. And that is something that they don't do anywhere else in the world but in the USA.
It's a good point. Even in England now, where there's technically a Triple Crown for the three-year-old colts, really the third leg has sort of since been usurped by the Arc as the goal, where presumably the best, fastest three-year-olds would go anyway. So, and of course, the idea of how quickly it all takes place here, the three races in 5 weeks. Another thing that I think is so attractive for me personally about racing in the U.S., you had an opportunity to attend your very first Breeders' Cup just a week and a half ago, or whenever it was at this point. Was curious to get your impressions. Did it live up to expectation?
It absolutely did. I mean, the Breeders' Cup itself is touted as being the world championships, and it really seems to be. I mean, the internationals coming over, and oh, thank God, Iridessa won for Joseph O'Brien, because I was getting, you know, I think we were all getting a bit nervous there. But really, the event that's put on, and the international competition, and the date on the calendar just seems to work really well. So it absolutely lived up to its reputation for me, and I felt so lucky that I was able to attend.
What was your favorite story coming out of this year's Breeders' Cup?
Oh, that's a tricky one. Actually, I was a little bit heartbroken that Dahia for Roger Varian didn't end up winning the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf, which was won by Sharing for actually a fellow Englishman in Graham Motion. But God, I had seen her run back in Europe, and I'm just such a big fan of her. She was a Group 2 winner back at home, the Sheffield Rockfall Stakes winner. And she finished second, a really good second. So to me, that's still, I think we're going to see so much more of her. But I mean, the story for me, the Breeders' Cup is Breeders' Cup Classic. Vino Rosso winning. He was a horse that me and our entire production team at the New York Racing Association had been following so closely. I mean, of course, the East Coast has done incredibly well as the jockeys during this year's Breeders' Cup. But to see him just beat all of them by so far and provide Trainer Top Flex with his first ever Breeders' Cup Classic win, that to me was quite the story.
It is nice to see Pletcher, having done such a great job with that horse, get rewarded. His numbers are still amazing. But, you know, for someone like me who was in New York racing half a dozen years ago, when it was everything was so Pletcher centric, and the Chad Brown dominance in New York now is such that, as weird as it sounds, even with all the success Pletcher still has, sometimes it seems like he takes a back seat at Saratoga to the exploits of the Brown Barn. But for somebody who I've been a fan of for such a long time, it was good to see him back in the winner's circle for such a big event. And that was and you know, that Vino Rosso, just undeniably a very cool horse. So when can we expect to see you back on these shores, or is it all a work in progress at this point?
It's all work in progress, but I'm hoping to be back within the next few weeks for sure.
All right, excellent. We'll get a chance to get together and hopefully continue to have you as a correspondent from afar. You've done a great job bringing us these voices from around the industry, and we look forward to more of that. I'm going to hand it over to you, and then at the end of the show, when your interview with one Brad is over, I'm going to bring in another Brad to close things out today, and that's going to be Brad Anderson, the winner of the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. But for now, Naomi, the reins are yours. Off you go.
In 2018, he was called the Rising Star, yet this year he has definitely joined the top echelon with trainers, courtesy of his two phenomenal Breeders' Cup winners, I am, of course, talking about trainer Brad Cox,
who has joined us here today. Welcome, Brad, and thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with us.
Good morning, Naomi. Thank you for having me on.
So let's just dive right into it. It's been about a week and a half now. Has it sunken in yet? You've tripled your Breeders' Cup wins from 1 to 3 with your two incredible victories. Do you get the chance to reflect on how special this is for you and your team?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I find myself watching the replay of the both races pretty often. So, it's a great achievement for the barn. You know, they work hard and, put a lot of hours in. And, for the owners to give us an opportunity with these horses and to, you know, it's very special to put so much time and effort into these horses and then, you know, get so close and then to execute, it means a lot, you know, very, very happy for the clients and the help.
It must have been very special. And did you get the chance to celebrate or is it business as usual the next day?
It was business as usual. We were loading those horses that won on Friday. Well, then at 1 o'clock in the morning. So it was a short night and we had to put the horses on the plane about eight or nine hours after Breeders' Cup was over and back to Kentucky they went and we were on a plane the next morning. So it was business as usual the next day. And it was a great trip.
Well, it's definitely a very successful trip, but quite the gruesome schedule there. Let's talk about your two Breeders' Cup winners. How has Breeders' Cup Fillies Juvenile winner British Idiom come out of her race?
Really good. We actually took her to the track a couple times this week, just make sure she was moving good. She appeared to be moving well the morning after, and shipping her back to Churchill. We, you know, give her 4 or 5 days off, and she was moving fine. We took her to the track and, wanted to see what her normal rider thought of her and thought she felt excellent. And we're just going to back off of her now. She's starting a little bit of a break. We're going to do it in the barn. She's just going to stay here. We're not going to turn her out or anything. We just leave her here. And, we'll just probably the first part of December start doing some light exercise with her and getting her ready for a 2020 campaign.
Yeah. Well, she's a 2-time grade one winner already and only 3 starts. Have you got any long-term goals yet or just take it as it goes?
Well, you obviously take it as it goes with these horses, but the goal would be the Kentucky Oaks. We'll work back from the Kentucky Oaks, hopefully have her peak that day, the first Friday in May, and see what happens. But, you know, I think just right now we're looking at, you know, possibly 2 starts prior to that where those starts will be. I don't know. We're going to win her at the fairgrounds. She will head to the fairgrounds in New Orleans either late November, early to mid December, just kind of see how the weather is in Kentucky. Horses enjoy cold weather and it's cold here now. So she's just kind of, like I said, not much going on. She's just walking 2 times a day and enjoying that and just kind of getting a little bit of a break.
Well, I remember how cold the winters get in Kentucky. So if you and the horses enjoy it, then, you know, by all means. But
the horses enjoy it. I don't.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I remember it gets so cold that you basically have about 10 different layers on. But if it works for your fillies as well, because I find that quite an interesting concept, actually, that we used to think in Europe that some of the fillies don't tend to like the cold as much. But you say that's actually not the case?
No, I feel like all horses like the cold weather. I've always felt like we go south because obviously the track conditions are better down south. But I've always felt we go south because mostly the track conditions and the people like it a little better. But horses enjoy cold weather. I do believe. I mean, they tend to be a little more fresh and feeling good and kind of, just think they enjoy the cold weather. Not super cold, but cool weather. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, so it's more the riders and the workers that really get bogged down
exactly.
on it. All right, well, let's have a quick chat as well about Covfefe. I don't even know if I say that correctly because I heard different pronunciations. How do you pronounce Covfefe?
I say Covfefe.
I said it wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm, don't ask me, but I know she's fast. That's all I know. She's a freak. But she bounced out of it in great shape. Really, really good. She's going to get a little break in Florida, in Ocala. The McCaffins brothers, they broke her. And she went her down there last year for a brief bit after the Frisette. last fall, and she's going to get a little freshening, and then she'll resume training at the fairgrounds.
Okay. And do you have any other sort of long-term goals for her? So I'm really glad to hear that they've both come out so well.
Yeah. Right now, I think the goal would be the Madison at Keeneland or the Humana Distaff at Churchill. Those would be goals. You know, those are great ones. They're prestigious races. The Ballerina at Saratoga would be something we would target. And ultimate goal would be to get back to the Breeders' Cup next year at Keeneland. So those are, big goals for 2020. And, I'm not saying we'll start back in a grade one, we'll get the team will put their heads together between Jamie, Alex, and Jason Litt. We'll come up with the same plan and kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm. So talking a bit about your stable stars in the same vein, how is Monomoy Girl doing?
She's doing really well. She actually just shipped to Ocala, to Paul Sharp's farm. And she's still on a little bit of a break and should resume training the 1st of December. And hopefully we look to have her back in the barn in New Orleans the 1st of January.
Well, that's very good to hear, 'cause I remember when we were at Saratoga, there was talk of her perhaps making an appearance there, but that didn't go as planned.
No, she obviously had a setback, and we were hoping to get a couple starts in her this fall, but we had a setback. Nothing major, just required some time, and hopefully she'll make it back. I mean, it'd be a big ask for her to come back, off such a long layoff. But if she makes it back, she'll be ready. We're not going to run her unless she's doing extremely well and training forward. So it'll be up to her if she can handle it or not. If she can't, we'll retire and she'll go make babies.
Yeah, well, we're all hoping to see a return, of course, but if not, she'll probably make a wonderful mother. But talking a little bit about your, it's in a way, your stable stars seem to all be females. Would you say that you have a knack for developing top females, or would it be sort of, is it patience that works with them, or how do you look at it?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, I'm hoping that we've in the end of January, we'll have had three champions, and you're right, they're all female. But, I think that, we'll end up getting the colts and down the road. And, I think we have some nice colts this year that could end up being some, decent three-year-olds and kind of go from there.
Are there any horses that you're touting? Because I was actually going to ask you about your colts. Have you got any stars that you're very much looking forward to next season?
We have a couple colts that have broke their maiden. One in particular is actually a gelding, not a colt. It's a horse named Answer In for Bob LaPenta's. Very nice horse that ran extremely well first time. It's very green, didn't break well. That was going three quarters, and then we stretched him out to 7/8. Give him plenty of time. He ran a big number first time and responded well in his second start, going 7/8. We think he's got a bright future. He's mentally, he can be a little tough to deal with, but He's shown up in both of his races and ran big races, brought nice numbers, and we think he could move forward as a three-year-old.
Great. Well, we'll hope that he'll be a nice three-year-old indeed, and then we can say that we heard about him here first. So
there you go.
I'd like to actually have a bit of a chat with you about when you started training. You actually learned from Bert Kessinger, Jimmy Baker, and then you were a few years assistant trainer to Dallas Stewart. Mm-hmm. What would you say that you learned from them, or what have you taken away that you're still applying today?
Well, I always felt with Dallas, I mean, we had a large number of horses, and I think, you learn that's, the Dwayne Lucas school of just, trying to be organized. I mean, obviously, having a lot of horses, you got to pay attention, and you got different people in place, and you got different divisions, and you just try to stay as organized as you can is probably the biggest thing. As far as, you pick up horsemanship from all those guys. I mean, all of them were, good horsemen, and, you try to pick up on things. Your brain is a sponge at that point in your life, and you're just absorbing everything and just trying to, figure out, horsemanship, small things that, add up to be big things in the end. And every stop was a great lesson.
Yeah. And when I was looking at when you first started training, it actually seems a little bit, not confusing, but maybe you can clarify a little bit. In 2004, you had your first winner, but but then somewhere it says that you started training in 2005. Could you clarify that a little bit?
Well, I started the very, like, December of, or maybe November of 2004, I believe was November. So I just had, I think I started with like 5 or 6 horses and, you know, was able to run a couple of them the end of 2004. So we really didn't have a full stable or race much. And then, you know, it's like anything, it's just getting going. I mean, it took us a while to get going. I think our biggest breakthrough was probably when we picked up Midwest, and I want to say 2010, we picked up Midwest Thoroughbreds, and that was our big break. I mean, we had, you know, just kind of struggled, you know, the first 4 or 5 years training, and, you know, most people do. I mean, I think if you look back at a lot of the top trainers, you'd see that, you know, in the beginning, it's always rough. You got to build your business, and, you know, that was a big break for us because we were able to start claiming horses and received a lot of horses, and we got our numbers up. We went from having, you know, probably 10, 15 horses to, you know, 40 or 50. So we experimented with that and worked with that outfit for, you know, a couple of years. And then we had parted ways and we had to kind of start over again, and we built it back up, and it's been good. It's really been good the last few years with quality and improving our stock each and every year. And, you know, hopefully it doesn't slow down. We keep the train rolling.
Well, you've definitely shown to be doing very well. You're win percentage has only dropped below 25% once in the last 10 seasons. So you've done an incredible job. But as you mentioned, you sort of went down, back down in numbers a little bit about 7 years ago. What kept you going when you said you had to start all over again?
Well, I mean, you just, you don't really have a choice. I mean, it just depends on what you want. And, you know, we wanted good horses, and, you know, I had to start claiming again and, you know, going to sales and, you know, meeting the right people. You know, Liz Crowe's been a big factor in our business as far as, you know, putting good horses on our barn and, you know, just connected with you know, the right people that are supplying us with horses, clientele, owners, Saul Kuhman, the Klein family, Judmont, Goodoff, and now supports us. So it's been really, really good. We've got a tremendous group of owners that have, you know, seemed to very loyal and trust us with quality stock.
Yeah. And you mentioned you have to want it enough. Is training horses something that you always wanted to do, or what is it that you like so much about it?
Yeah. You know, at an early age, I grew up by Churchill, and it, you know, I always was fascinated with the sport. And, you know, I think when I was probably in high school, I was like, you know, I want to try to make a living doing that. I feel like I have a passion for it. I want to do it. You know, I was just like, you know, this training thing, I mean, maybe try to figure it out. And, you know, I just always had kind of had a vision, a goal, trying to make it. And it's tough. I mean, it's not something you're going to walk in and, you know, work for someone for 6 months. It's years and years of getting up early and, you know, meeting the right people and, you know, doing right by the horses. And it's a grind. I mean, you know, I always tell people, like, you know, people that work 9 to 5, I mean, you know, they work Monday through Friday, and, you know, lots of times our dark days are Mondays and Tuesdays, and we're still working, but, you know, we don't really have a lifestyle like, I guess you would say, the normal 9 to 5 people. I mean, lots of times when people want to do things on the weekends, or your friends may be doing things, I mean, you can't do that. You got to be at the races, and you're working all day and getting up on Sunday morning, you know, working horses. So it's a demanding job. And, you know, I know a lot of people think they want to do it, but when they get into it, you see how demanding it is with the travel and up and down the road and, you know, leaving home for months at a time. I mean, it's extremely demanding and tough. And, you know, it's a hard job, I promise you that.
So actually getting a little bit in about working and racing, when I visited your barn, I always see your son there, Blake, as well. And he seems to be playing such a big role within your team or within your operation. And would you have told him, you know, it's really hard, I don't think you should be getting into this? Or are you very happy with him to play?
It's up to him. I mean, no one ever told me, you know, I had people tell me, oh, you know, this is tough, you're never going to make it, this and that. But no, I'll support him 100% if this is what he wants to do. I feel like he has a passion for it. Totally has a passion for it. He loves it, and he's really, really good at it. And you know, I think as long as he, you know, keeps his work ethic, he'll be successful, very successful in this.
Would you say this will become sort of a proper family run operation then, or Is there a future in him taking over?
Yeah, I think it could. I mean, I guess, you know, I've always said that. I said, you know, maybe someday I'll walk away from this and leave it to him, and maybe I'll be the one who goes out and recruits the horses for him. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. As of right now, I don't feel like I'm going to be slowing down anytime soon. I'm enjoying what I'm doing and having fun doing it.
Oh, I'm pretty sure you're quite young yourself as well still. So I'm sure there's still plenty of years left for you to be making your mark, even though you've already been, you know, having tremendous success. Just wanted to touch a little bit upon a little bit of a different subject, just because I wanted to pick your brain about this. When it comes to, for example, the Breeders' Cup, we had incredibly stringent veterinary procedures, and it's really been a challenging year for the industry. And as a trainer with a very large number of horses under your care, what do you believe would be viable changes that are needed or will be able to bring us forward in the horse racing industry?
Well, as far as the Breeders' Cup goes, I mean, I thought the vets did a tremendous job of evaluating the horses all week. I mean, we had no issues. I mean, I can't speak for other barns on how they felt. But, you know, I thought that the veterinary group did a good job. I think they – different groups of vets every day. So, I mean, I think each horse had 3 evaluations and there were 2 vets. So, I mean, you had, I think, 6 different horses looking – I'm sorry, 6 different vets looking at each horse. So, you know, I thought they had everything in place they needed. It's just going to be extremely hard to prevent everything from happening in this game as far as breakdowns go. Things are going to happen, unfortunately. You know, I thought the Breeders' Cup did a fine job. Santa Anita and the Breeders' Cup putting the show on in Southern California, and it was a well-run weekend, I thought.
Well, as you mentioned, it's unfortunately inevitable that sometimes things happen. You can't prevent them from happening. But do you believe that we might hence have to educate the further public about, you know, how horse racing works and perhaps change the perception so we can be moving forward as an industry?
Yeah. I mean, something needs to be done. And I do not have the answer for that. You have to talk to someone that, you know, I don't really have an answer for that. But you're right. I mean, something needs to be done because, I mean, you know, when something negative happens, I mean, that's all they want to talk about. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, that's what news is about. A lot of times what's negative. I mean, you turn on the 6 o'clock news and, I mean, they don't start out the news with a great story lots of times. So that's unfortunately what makes the news lots of times. You know, bottom line, it's like playing football. I mean, you know, they're not going to be able to play football without concussions here or there. I mean, it's just going to happen, or, you know, torn ACLs. So, it's just whenever there's contact and, you know, physical, athletic involvement, there's going to be injuries. But, you know, horse racing, it's a great sport and it supports a lot of people. And, you know, it's been a rough year, but hopefully we'll get through it.
Yeah. Well, as you say, with any athlete, there's injuries, but unfortunately when it comes to horses, there's quite often not always something that we can do. But so does it worry you? Because obviously this is your livelihood and this is what you've been doing as well as your family. Does it worry you the future of racing in the USA?
I mean, I don't know if it worries me, but I mean, it's a concern. You know, it's just something that, you know, I have to take care of my business and take care of my horses. And hopefully we can, like I said, get through it. It's something that's, you know, unfortunate, but, you know, hopefully we can move past it.
Absolutely. I mean, we both very much love the industry. So I very much hope as well that we can get through this and we'll come out better at the end. But Brad, I feel like I've taken up too much of your time already, and thank you so much for having a chat with us here today. And I do hope everything will go well, but you are certainly on the right path.
Thank you very much, Naomi. Thanks for having me on.
And now I'd like to welcome to the In the Money airwaves the latest Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge champion, Brad Anderson. Brad, how are you today?
I am good, Pete. I'm doing well. And yourself?
Life is good. Life is good. Grinding away here in the Brooklyn Bunker on a Monday afternoon, and very happy to be speaking with you. Let's start off with a pretty basic one. It's been about a week and a half since you won the BCBC. Has it sunk in yet?
You know, Pete, I don't think it has. It was such a whirlwind, you know, weekend closing that out with that victory, and then the celebrations and then the trip home and reliving the stories with my friends and family and rewatching the races. Because in the contest, you can watch the races, but you don't get the full effect. But just rewatching the races and just letting it sink in that, you know, I won a tournament that put me up against the best of the best. So, I mean, it is sinking in a little bit, but still it is a feeling that I don't want to have go away for a long time. And, I want to bask in the at least the inner joy that I have of accomplishing this remarkable feat.
I'm working on this new book project that I think I've talked to you about a little bit off air about most memorable days at the racetrack. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that this one is yours.
Yeah, clearly top of the list, nothing even close to this. And, you know, when you look at the money, to me, that is the aspect that I was so focused on just winning the tournament. And then when you take a step back and look at, you know, the picture of the check and the number of zeros on that check, it was just clearly a highlight that I don't think will be ever matched, and clearly my best day at the track and one that I'll never forget.
Let's go back to the beginning of your racing fandom. Where did it all start for you?
So I grew up in the Midwest, and I recall my grandfather visiting some Greyhound racetracks, and I went with him once or twice. And I was at a young age, so I really didn't understand everything other than seeing him get excited when he picked the winning Greyhound. And then, you know, innocently it started. My mom, I got an older brother and two sisters, and my mom would get us in the living room the first Saturday of every May. And we would just take in the Kentucky Derby, and she would ask us to select a winner, you know, and we would select a winner. And back then it was the number, it was the horse's name, you know, things that just caught you in your youth. And then in 1973, I remember I just happened to pick Secretariat in the Kentucky Derby. And
good choice.
You know, he just captured my heart. And then I got introduced to other Triple Crown races and watched him follow up on that pursuit of the Triple Crown and just was hooked. Just loved that story, loved the aspect of Secretariat being an athlete and the way that he was competing. It was fascinating. So, you know, that's how I got started. And then really not a lot, you know, I would always enjoy the Triple Crown races. But then I got a job, I got a family, I was busy, you know, other priorities. And not really until about 4 or 5 years ago did I get back into at least, but I'll say more than the Triple Crown races, where I would go to Arlington Park, which I consider it to be my home track. I, you know, grew up and raised and worked in the Chicagoland. So then I would go maybe 6 to 8 times a year, not a lot. And it was always with friends, and it was always just to enjoy the environment, to watch the horses and jockeys compete. And then I started understanding a little bit more about how you could try to gamble and make a little money on the races. But yeah, started out with just an innocent introduction, and now to see it come full circle is amazing.
We need to pause on that progression a little bit. When you started getting more serious about actually playing the horses, was there a specific impetus for that, a friend, a mentor, a book? How did that transition begin?
Yeah, you know, the transition began when there was an associate of mine that I worked with, Matt Miller, who is a mutual friend of ours, Pete, and he started introducing me a little more to the racing, the handicap process, and understanding how to make bets and how to make money. So Matt has been a good friend and has, you know, helped me get back into this sport, and one that requires a lot more analysis than just picking, you know, Secretariat back in the 70s based on, you know, the name. And he's been a good friend through this process. And then, you know, I started, I think it, there was a TV show, The Horse Players, that I watched,
sure.
I think back in the mid 2015, maybe, and really got introduced to this whole contest playing. And I'd never really been introduced to that at all until then. And I entered a tournament in Arlington Park, was fortunate to win an entry into the NHC in 2017, competed in that, and then competed in the BCBC down in Churchill Downs last year. Was just fascinated with that. The environment, the legends of the game from a handicapping perspective, seeing them, having the opportunity to meet a couple of them, really opened my eyes to the other side of the contest plane of handicapping, and still consider myself a novice in this. But that really is the progression from a handicapping to a contest player.
Well, the novice schooled the pros the other weekend at the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. What was your strategy heading into those 2 days?
I had gone back and really done some research on the past winners and saw, you know, the trend that I thought could work for me, which was, you know, keep the bets as simple as possible. You know, primarily win bets, daily doubles are exactive if they presented some added value to the horses that I liked. But I wanted to have some powder. I wanted to have some money going into the last two races. Because I saw, you know, in my research that you needed to have a meaningful balance going into those races if you wanted to win the tournament. And being a competitive guy, I simply wanted to win the tournament. I wanted to beat the best. I liked that challenge. I took small minimum bets across the two days of the Breeders' Cup. I was looking for value, and when I did have a strong opinion, I would take some larger bets, but I really wanted to have a balance, significant balance, and a chance to compete for the title as the Breeders' Cup came to a close.
What were some of your plays that got you there? Because you went in not just with your minimums out of the way and your starting bankroll,
yeah,
but went in there with some serious powder.
On Friday, I didn't win any. I had three small bets that I made and really didn't win any. And then starting on the second day with the Phillies and Mare Sprint, I loved Covfefe. I just loved her battle with Sargenti Empress in the test. And I placed a win bet. And then I also did a daily double with Covfefe and some higher prices, and you'll get a kick out of this. You know, a couple of the horses that we did the daily double with, when I looked at where we could really find value, was Empress, which I know listening to In the Money podcast was yours, and then Belfour Bay, which was Jonathan's. So fortunately I hit that daily double first thing on Saturday, and really then had some significant winnings in my balance that then started to prep me for the Classic. And then the next race, the Dirt Mile, then I did a small wager on Fun to Run. And this was another horse that just intrigued me, you know, with the high buyer at the park and then listening to experts talk about, was it a true speed figure, was it not, and seeing that some of the horses that Fun to Run beat, then came back and won their next race, had that horse stand out to me. So those were the only two winning bets that I had going into the Classic, was that daily double with Covfefe and then Belfour Bay, and then in the Dirt Mile, Fun to Run, and then just made some small bets leading up to the Classic.
It looked to me like your strategy involved really trying to keep your wagering as simple as possible. You mentioned the doubles you played. I know there were a lot of win bets. How did you avoid the temptation to dip into the deeper exotics like the exacta and trifecta?
It came back to the strategy, and I wanted to be disciplined, and I really wanted to try to keep it simple and try to make a bet that really would bring the excitement of a winning bet. And in a lot of these exactas and trifectas, you know, in my experience, I get two of the three, or I get one of the two. And it leaves me with just a bad feeling when I miss on those exotics. And that's really, you know, I did a couple of them in the contest, but it really would be when I thought there was just a clear cut winner, and then I'd try to get some horses to come in second. But yeah, it was just a discipline that I wanted to keep it simple. I'm still a novice. I'm still learning, you know, how to really get value in the exotics and something that I'd like to aspire to be better at. But right now I knew what I was good at. I knew what I wanted to do from a strategy perspective and focused on more of the simple bets.
I love the way you played those last two races. We've talked about it a bit off air. We talked about it a little bit on camera in that vid we shot for Breeders' Cup. But I want to hear about how you decided to allocate your money across your two entries heading into the Breeders' Cup turf.
On my other entry, I was sitting right under 11,000. And so I did a daily double with Bricks and Mortar, who I thought clearly was going to be the winner in the turf, and then picked three price horses because when the turf went off, I didn't know exactly what number I needed, but I knew I needed to get a number probably north of 120. So I settled on Yoshida, War of Will, and Higher Power. So I knew once the turf was over that now I had Yoshida, War of Will, and Higher Power going into the Classic on my one entry. So I felt like I was in really good shape there. So then I went to the winning entry, and I passed on the turf because I felt like I had enough of a balance to take on the leader at that point.
What was it, about 27,000? About 27,000 on the good entry heading into the turf that you decided to pass on. Is that, am I remembering that right?
25,900.
Close enough.
You know, then it became clear to me where the leader was just north of 137. And in my handicapping, I had come down to two horses that I loved in the Classic, and that was McKenzie and Vino Rosso. You know, when I looked at their races this year, you know, Vino Rosso loved in the Gold Cup at Santa Anita. I also liked him in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, where unfortunately he got DQ'd. But I loved his grit when it comes to the home stretch in the final 16th pole. And McKenzie, I thought, had, you know, all season long was the top horse. But then it became a mathematical exercise for me where I knew I needed to get north of 140.
That's because that's where the leader's total went to, 138 after the turf, bigger number than you anticipated.
As the race was settling in and the odds were settling, McKenzie was at 5-2. Vino Rosso was at 9-2. And that really made the decision for me because my strategy was I was going to bet it all. I wasn't looking to, you know, finish in the top 10 for an NHC seat or top 15, whatever they awarded. I wasn't looking to recoup my entry fee. I really wanted to win the contest. So the win bet on Vino Rosso, 25,900, you know, set me up across both my entries with four horses that I considered had a shot. You know, then watching the Classic kickoff, it was an out-of-body experience because it was just watching the race, knowing the horses that I had. You know, a little bit of fear when McKenzie made his move, but then Vino Rosso just wound up and again hit that home stretch. It was just a remarkable feeling to see that play out in front of my eyes.
He gets on his belly and runs, that Vino Rosso. There's no doubt about it. I think you did identify a good quality in him. But just to recap that for folks, just to underline how clever it was, On the second entry, you were alive to the three longer shots, and then you had the 25 and change to fire. Wanted to fire it at McKenzie, and if the bankroll had been around 100, if the leader's bankroll had been around 100 going in, you would have fired it at McKenzie. But because Dick Girardi, I believe it was, in the turf, had crushed the race, all of a sudden you knew that you were going to need to get that bankroll up over 120. So you decided to get off your top pick, McKenzie, and go instead with Vino Rosso, who ended up winning. So it's kind of funny. I mean, had you had your, it's just funny to think about. If you'd had your way, if you'd played your top pick, you wouldn't have ended up winning. How big a role does luck play for you in these contests?
It plays a huge role, Pete. I mean, to me, looking at my notes, looking at where I put these horses, and clearly I thought McKenzie was going to win the Classic. But when you come to this contest, it's as simple as the math. And you know, I'm an analytical guy, I'm a technology guy, so I knew exactly where I needed to be. It's very, very fortunate that Vino Rosso ended up winning, because if McKenzie would have won the race, you know, I would have been down to zero. I wouldn't have won anything. It would have been a great experience. But because the math told me I needed to go Vino Rosso and Vino Rosso won, it was extremely lucky. I think it was hard work to get up to that point. It was hard work to give me the choice between Vino Rosso and McKenzie. But then it was just extremely lucky that Vino Rosso won the Classic.
I think a lot of people in that situation might have just looked to the Exacta pool, but I would imagine since you had this philosophy going in, it had served you effectively for 2 days, that you decided to keep it simple and not have to worry about who was going to run first and second when you could just worry about who was going to be first. Did you give any serious consideration, though, to some sort of Exactas with McKenzie on top, or all along did you know you wanted to keep it simple and have a horse to win in that spot?
As the Classic was leading up, I truly looked at some Exactas, and you know, the simple one would have been the Box, McKenzie, and Vino Rosso. But, to me, then you think about, okay, well, you got to include some of these other horses, and do I try to do a variety of Exactas? And that just got too complicated for me, and one in which, you know, again, I aspired to be a little bit better there, to look at that, because there may have been a better way to achieve what I was looking for. But in the end, it came back to my strategy, my simple approach. And when I looked at all of the different, paths to this victory, it just seemed to me that simplicity was the way I was going to go. And that's where I ended up on Vino Rosso.
Nearly 500,000 later, I think we can say that was the right choice. I wanted to ask you about your victory celebration. I know from our time hanging out in Chicago that you're a wine guy. What wines were on the menu that night?
You know, we had some Arrow Branch Cab, which was drinking very, very well. I think we had a Checkerboard, which is, again, one of my favorite Napa cabs. And then, of course, we had to move off the wine and get some good spirits, and I think I have some Basil Hayden and some good Angel's Envy, I think, with some nightcappers. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. I tell this story to my kids. I have, four adult kids now. And they said, well, it was clear on who you needed to pick because you love wine and, you know, Vino Rosso. And it brought me back to the simpler approach that my mom would teach us, which is, you know, pick a horse that's got a name that means something. So they thought that was a fitting end to the story. And you know, my mom just passed a year ago, so it was really just, when I think about it, just a lot of the stars were lined up, and it was just a great experience.
Oh, that's fantastic stuff. The family reaction, I take, was pretty jubilant to the whole thing.
Yeah, you know, they were just in shock because they know that I have just started to participate in these contests, and I talk in high esteem of, you know, people like yourself and Jonathan and others who really have helped educate me. And then they say, you went out there and you beat these experts? I said, yeah, I did. I was fortunate. I was put in a position and made the right decision. And, you know, they're proud now. They want to know when the big celebration will be. And, you know, we'll get together over the holidays and relive it with all of them. But it was fun.
No doubt the Vino Rosso will be flowing once again. Hey, there's more stuff to come potentially in this story. As a result of this win, you are alive for a $3 million bonus should you go on to win this year's National Horse Players Championship. You've competed in the event before. You have some idea of what you're getting into. How excited are you about this possibility to make a little bit more history at the NHC in early February?
Yeah, you know, extremely excited. And you know, earlier in the year, I was fortunate to be introduced to Scott Coles, another Chicago area horse player who won the NHC last year. So I may be giving Scott a call up and get a little bit of pre-contest advice and see if he can direct me into the key strategy to win that tournament. But yeah, you know, it's extremely exciting. I competed in the NHC once, but back in 2017. So I've got a little bit of experience, and it's a different type of contest. So I'm going to have to do my homework and in the end, get extremely lucky again to be in that position. But yeah, I mean, to have a bonus like that available to me, I'm assuming it'll put more pressure on me, but I hope I just keep disciplined and simple in the way that I approach it.
It's got to be fun to dream on it for a couple months, if nothing else. I mean, just to be alive for that kind of score, I would imagine it's pretty exciting and something that's going to motivate you in your horse playing to come. How much are you playing day in, day out? I mean, are you more big day focused, or are you looking all the time when it comes to racing?
I am more of a big race player. I probably won't do much betting until the new year. I just recently moved down to Florida, so just trying to get settled here and make that transition. You know, probably, you know, after the new year, then I'll start, you know, paying attention, watching some of the races. I mean, the NHC is just completely different because of the setup being across a variety of tracks as opposed to a big focus like we had in Santa Anita for the Breeders' Cup. So I think I'm going to start paying a little more attention, but it won't be until after the holidays. I just want to relax and bask in this great feeling and continue the celebration through the end of the year.
I think you deserve that break for sure. We haven't talked at all during this interview about your professional career. Tell folks what it is that you did/do.
I retired about 3 years ago from just a 35-year career in technology. I was on the application development side of technology. I was with the same company for 35 years and very successful in helping grow and develop and lead that company. And it put me in a place where, as I said, I retired at a fairly young age. And you know, my wife and I just moved to the Sarasota area and just looking forward to enjoying the time and life of just traveling and spending time with our adult children and future grandchildren. And the career was one that I look back on and loved every minute of it. But, you know, there's different phases in life. And now I'm looking forward to just more relaxation and enjoyment.
That sounds pretty good. A proper retirement, in other words, with some occasional horse playing mixed in. Hey, this is the kind of question I would normally ask off air, but you know, sometimes we get a little loosey goosey on the show, and we'll do it now. I understand you have a personal connection to a regular listener/sometimes guest/advisor of this show, Eric Bielek. What is your connection to Eric?
You know, it is such a strange connection, and it just shows what a small world we all live in. But Eric's dad and I worked together for many, many years, and I got introduced to Eric's parents, and they're both just great people. And then we had, you know, interactions. My oldest son played youth baseball on traveling teams with Eric. So I got to see Eric when he was developing his athletic prowess, and got to know him, you know, through my eldest son. But I haven't been able to get the wisdom from Eric on the horse plane. I know I see him now and then and see articles that he writes, but it's largely based on his parents, who I worked with, Eric's dad, for many, many years, and got to know them through, you know, youth baseball and then high school.
Libertyville, Illinois, right? Is that the essential?
There you
connection?
Go, Libertyville, Illinois, just outside of Chicago.
And then Eric, of course, also renowned to listeners as my running coach. I'm going to be bothering him again soon about some whatever the new goals are going to be. But I wouldn't have had nearly as positive of an experience running that half marathon back in March if it wasn't for Coach Bialik. So I find it funny that he's a part of this story as well. Any final reflections from you, Brad? About this win or upcoming opportunities? It's great to have you on the show today, and just want to give you a chance to get your voice out there to the horse players.
Pete, I don't think you expected me to say this, but I got to give In the Money Players Podcast a lot of credit. To me, getting into the contest world and understanding all of the different moving pieces, but to listen to you and Jonathan and then your guests has just been a treat for me, and I mean, that's part of this experience, is starting to meet people that I hear on your show that are just full of wisdom and expertise, has really, really been a benefit. So I just want to thank you and Jonathan for bringing a very novice entry-level horse player into the world that's very competitive and up against some of the best handicappers in the world, and on a given weekend can get lucky and win the tournament. So, it's been a pleasure to meet you and to listen to your podcast and how you bring a lot of different angles to the horse player. So thank you very much. There is a little bit of a thanks here that I wouldn't have been in a position to make that special day happen without some insight coming from both you and Jonathan and your guests.
Well, we thank you immensely, Brad. That's very kind of you to say, and we appreciate it. And if there was any small way in which we helped, we appreciate the reflected glory of your fantastic win. And, you credit luck, but I think it's one of those things where the harder you work, the luckier you get. And the more good decisions you make, the luckier you get. But of course, on any given day, it does take a little bit of that. And so glad that it worked for you come this Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, and we'll be rooting for you in the future as well. Brad, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Pete. You have a great day.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I want to thank Naomi Tucker, Brad Cox, and Brad Anderson. I want to thank our sponsors, especially Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and 10 Strike Racing. Stats Race Lens as well. We'll throw them in there for a thank you. Had a lot of fun doing that Breeders' Cup Day Pick 6 show, and even heard one or two people who helped hit the bet because of that Stats Race Lens show. That was pretty cool. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. Black Type Thoroughbreds is a new thoroughbred racing partnership that gives you the chance to get in the game. Not many of us have the money to buy our own professional sports franchise, but you can have a somewhat similar experience in the world of thoroughbred racing with a partnership like Black Type. Black Type's deep connections in the industry mean you're going to get top-level access to the best horsemen and horses. It's a great way to get involved. People are always asking me what they can do to learn more about ownership. Being involved in a partnership like Black Type that has a low markup and great people involved like Jake Ballas is the best way, I can tell you, to get involved as a thoroughbred owner. For more information, you can reach out to Jake directly and check out the information on his website. That web address is blacktypetb.com.